That we have, y'all wanted the microphone and I put it back up. That'll make sure that we have enough time to have some great discussions. But welcome and good morning. We're excited to be here and I hope all of y'all are as well. Just want to make sure everybody's in the room that they want to be in. This room, we're going to be discussing health impacts of our food system. That's where everybody wants to be? Woohoo! Okay, good, good. Well, my name is Mary Kate Mauser, and I was asked to facilitate this session. My background, I actually work at Children's Hospital right now, but one of the things that, as everybody's been talking, it's amazing to me how many people go back to how they were brought up and what their experiences were with food from the time that they were young. I grew up on a farm in Sumner County, a working farm, still working today. I actually have, my mom is a home ec teacher, my grandmother is a home ec teacher. She actually ran for the Gallatin school system, the nutrition program. But she was the first food director for the school system in Gallatin. So it's kind of interesting how your family's involvement and what you learn from your family, you grow up with, and it's a part of who you become and a part of the things that you find out that motivate you. So I just wanted to share that because I kept reflecting back on it. And my mom is now in public health, so it's a big circle when you look at it, and I'm sure everybody in this room has a similar experience of some sort. But today, what we're going to do, the format, just so everybody knows the format, is we're going to allow our speakers a little bit of time to talk about their experiences and some different topics that were part of the description. And then we're going to open it up for questions, because dialoguing is really where I think will spark a lot of conversations. It'll make your brain start working and thinking, how can we do different types of things? Who would we partner with? And so we'll just go ahead and get started. And I will turn it over to Ms. Tracy, and she can tell you about her work and how it relates to this topic.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
I am Tracy Buck, and I am a registered dietitian, and I work with the Metro Public Health Department here in Nashville. I am the director for health promotion at the health department. But my relation to this, besides being a dietitian, you know, we all do eat. I said, you know, a lot of the things that we do in health promotion, we do tobacco and other things, and we say, you know, you can avoid those things. But everyone has to eat. You can't take food away from people. So that's, you know, kind of a common factor that we all have. And I thought that since we're talking about health, and I was the first speaker, that I'd kind of set the stage for the health piece. And as I was looking over some things, poor dietary intake is a risk factor for many health conditions. We do know overweight and obesity, it's getting a lot of attention now. Cardiovascular disease, which is still the number one killer of people in the United States. Type 2 diabetes, hypertension, which they're finding more and more people have hypertension and don't necessarily know that. And then, of course, certain cancers. And when you look at Tennessee's rates for all of those conditions, we are worse than the national average. So we're not as healthy. So why do people have problems eating healthy? Well, it's a multitude of problems. It's very interrelated. The information that people get, they often get too much information. They don't know which piece of information to trust. They get multiple sources. They don't know what to eat because they're told today that it's healthy. Tomorrow it's not healthy. It's bad for you. You know, how much do I eat? Has anyone noticed portion sizes lately? How that they have exploded over the last 20 years? And even how often to eat? Should we eat 3 times a day? Should we eat 6 times a day? All of those are confusing factors for the general public. You know, I went to school for 8 years to become a dietitian, and you know, to learn how to deal with health and food. But the general public doesn't have that detailed knowledge, and it can sometimes be confusing. And then, you know, we want to, we all have personal foods. So, you know, for my family, you know, when we get together, we have a tendency to eat. We have a tendency to eat a lot. And it's not low-fat food. And, you know, now it is, you know, we do, you know, do fruits and vegetables, but they're not always prepared in the most healthy way. Because it's, you know, we're from the South, and, you know, we like our fat. So, you know, it's those kinds of things, how you retrain generations of people. It makes a difference. And then what are the environmental factors? What are the societal factors? You know, you have to look at families, organizations, at communities. They all have complexions, and they all have, you know, differences. But when we look at the environmental factors that affect how we eat and what we choose to eat, the media is a huge piece. I was watching television with my daughter the other day, and on one commercial break, out of 8 commercials that they played, 5 were for food, and they were not healthy options. And, you know, so, you know, there started a discussion with her. She's 8. So, you know, you can imagine what the discussion was. It's good, Mommy. So we have media influence. We have time factors. You know, if we work, then we have less time maybe to prepare healthier options. I had a conversation with some people that I work with the other day, and I have found out that I'm in a minority. And I just want to see about this group. Breakfast eaters, everybody eat breakfast? Okay. How many of you all eat breakfast with your family? Every day. Okay. Okay. Thank you.
I'm my family.
Okay. Well, families have different complexions. My husband and I take time every morning to sit down with our daughter and eat breakfast. And people are like, you're kidding me. You don't just send her out the door. Because that's something that we find to be important. We start the day together. We also eat dinner together. So, you know, but how do you find time? Because I work full time, my husband works full time. How do you find time to prepare healthy foods and do that in, you know, in this world where we're working 60 hours a week or more? Now, you have to try to carve out those times. And then comes the expense. Eating healthy can be more expensive, especially if you try to eat healthy and use those convenience foods. So all of those play a part in there. And then those organizational and community, those policy pieces, you know, what is available? You know, is it... healthier foods available in your neighborhood in a convenient place for you. Levels of income and education play a role in making the choices to eat healthy. I said I have 8 years worth of education to, you know, that has taught me how to make those healthy choices. But if someone doesn't have that knowledge, what is their handicap in learning how to eat healthy, you know, and teaching people how to do? And I was looking, of course, Tennessee has a higher rate of lower educated people, which does lead to lower income. And then I was looking at access, exposure. I mean, if you don't have access to healthy foods and you're not exposed to it, then how do you incorporate those foods into your lifestyle if you're unaware of them? If you've never seen a rutabaga or you've never seen kiwi or mangoes, I mean, you know, those are some foods that, you know, we may take for granted that some people that don't have access to those fruits and vegetables may not be aware of. So how do we start so that everyone has access to those things equally? Was posed, two selection strategies for people to know to choose healthy foods. One thing, the first selection strategy was to be able to read the food labels, to know what you're eating makes a difference. If people are taught and they know what they're eating and how they can do that, how to compare foods, and what impact will that have on the community? Well, you will have healthier individuals and families. And the second is to know your food source. And that may be harder if you're, to choose healthy foods if you're having to only shop at the convenience store or at the supermarket even. But to know where those healthier options reside and where those local foods are, and to be able to talk with those local growers to find out where those foods are and how to access those, and what impact does that have on the community? Well, it also helps with healthy families, but it's also an economic stimulus. So just some things that I thought of as I thought about how food and health go together.
Good. Barbara?
Thank you. My name is Barbara Clinton, and I'm the director of something called the Center for Health Services at Vanderbilt. And our center was actually founded by students in the 1960s and community people in coalition because... You guys may know this. Let me put this down for a second. Tennessee is this long, narrow, skinny state where we are now, and we're right sort of in the middle of it. Well, at Vanderbilt around the 1960s, while students in other parts of the country were making huge changes on the national scene, at Vanderbilt there was the same interest in making change, but it was a little more modulated, as you might expect at Vanderbilt, but not completely. But the students here, medical students, law students, nursing students, journalism students, philosophy students, etc., were starting to question, here we are, right here in this relatively affluent city, in terms of health, with all kinds of clinics and specialists and so on, and up here in Kentucky, like East Kentucky, Southern West Virginia, Virginia comes down in here like this, and then here's the Mississippi, and here we have Arkansas, Mississippi, Alabama, and Georgia. So along in here, there was tremendous, still is, poverty with a different cultural group from up here in Appalachia. But here these students were wondering what to do, and how could we be somehow helpful while we're sitting here with all this wealth that we've got. At the same time, in 1968, a Catholic sister from Campbell County, Tennessee, which is just this side of the Kentucky state line, came to visit the dean of the medical school at Vanderbilt, and she said, you're sitting here with all this stuff, and up in my county, we'd have no clinics. We do have a general practitioner, but we don't have an obstetrician. We don't have anybody who's a specialist in gynecology or oncology, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The dean said, oh, you need to talk to the students. So what grew out of that coalition of the students and the community people was the center that I work with. And in those early days, they did a lot of things with Bethlehem Centers, thanks to Joyce Searcy, who helped those students get trained and so on. Anyway, growing out of this is like 40 years ago. Now we have many, many, many projects all scattered around in here, always in coalition with community people. And one of the commonalities with the communities up here and here is poverty. Different reasons, different cultural groups. Up here, This is the region where in the late 19th and early 20th century, business interests from London, Toronto, New York, etc., came in and took, first they took the trees, then they came back and they took the coal. And they didn't put back in there in the form of taxation revenue that could be used for good schools and jobs and transportation, etc. Down here, we have the heritage first of slavery, then Jim Crow, and continued discrimination, which kept people from having the opportunity to get a decent education, buy property, own land, maintain some sort of long-term security. So you have two areas of relatively serious poverty, different historical reasons, but today, or 5 years ago, 5 years from now, a lot of the same common issues. So we try to work with people in all of those regions. And one of the things that we've learned is even though the natural resources in some of these places have basically been stripped in a big way, what remains is what our country's premier natural resource is, which is the local people who live in these communities who have still been gardening and doing the best they can with their kids, participating actively in their faith communities. Up here, they were organizing for safety in the coal mines. Down here, organizing for the right to vote, the right to sit wherever they want in the waiting room, etc. There's this heritage in our region, meaning Tennessee and around, of people who have basically been exploited, saying, I don't like this, and nobody's going to help me, so we're going to have to get together in our church basement and figure out what to do. So that sort of set the stage for these students to come in and just kind of build on that. So they could in no way replace that sort of local strength and backbone and experience and history. But they do know how to do research, and they know how to put together a set of talking points that a community might want to use in a meeting with the school system or in a meeting with the local health department and so on. So getting back to the hunger issue, hunger's always been an issue in these communities, except until the last two generations, in both regions, there was a heritage of people feeding themselves through their own gardens or through their own cow or something like that. That's pretty much going. There aren't very many working farms left in these areas, and it's always great to hear of one that has survived. And what's come into play now is hunger. And if you define hunger as the absence of a steady stream of nutritious food, then that's certainly the case in the inner city, as we'll probably hear from other speakers. My thing today is more the rural areas. But ironically, in the places where there used to be corn growing and tomatoes and all of that in a huge way, there isn't so much anymore. And people not only have the absence of that quality food that's grown in their own communities, but they are losing the habit of eating those foods because in part they've become expensive, they're not available, and so on. And what we find is that's actually the hardest thing to work with. It's not that these people don't know what's right. It's not a matter of giving people information. It's more a matter of the cycle of how we work with food in our own lives. You know, that you both said, and so did other people say, you know, about your relationship to food in your own family. Well, you know, I think that that's absolutely true. And we now have situations where, for very good reasons, it makes the most sense to get a Happy Meal on the way home from work and feed it to your 7 and 8 year olds, because this is not because people don't want to be good parents. It's because this makes the most sense for them in terms of the economy and in terms of the time they have and their fatigue, and perhaps, you know, and perhaps now they don't really know how to cook. That, you know, the microwave, and I love my microwave, but it's sort of erasing Saturday afternoons where parents and kids are in the kitchen making chocolate chip cookies. Maybe not too nutritious, but kids are in the kitchen and they're having the fun of putting something together, sticking it in the oven, it comes out, it tastes good, I made that. It's good for the self-esteem and it's good for the experience and all that. We're sort of losing that, and that's one of the things we're hoping for, I think, with the Middle Tennessee Food Security Partnership, is get that back in there. It's not only that it makes you healthier in terms of your body, but it makes you healthier in terms of your relationships and your sense of achievement and all of that. So anyway, so we, one of the programs we have, and I'm probably running out of time here, works with mothers. And it's called the MIHOW program, Maternal Infant Health Outreach Worker Program. And what this program does is, on a mother-to-mother basis, moms encourage and help each other have a healthy pregnancy and give birth to a healthy baby and then get the baby off to a good start. Well, what's been happening is that we know from the studies that we do in this program that about one-third of the families report that they don't always have enough food to get through the month. So these are really poor people. About half of them are living at half the U.S. poverty level. So this is a serious thing, and it's absolutely a crime in our country that this should exist, but it does. And so now we're talking to them about buying apples and that sort of thing, which is simply out of the range in terms of the economics of it, but it's also getting out of the range in terms of people's habits. You get into a cycle, a family cycle, where you grow up with a certain kind of food, and that's what tastes good. And you want to put something different in front of your child or in front of your grandmother who grew up with that, and they say, no, I'm not eating it. So we have that kind of problem. So what I was hoping we could talk about when we get into the discussion is perhaps in the group, I mean, people who come to a meeting like this have been thinking about this problem and are concerned about this problem. I'm hoping that perhaps we might generate some ideas about how to reverse these cycles, or how to respecting the experience that families have on their own, help them change those cycles.
Can I reach? Can you hear me okay? I'm used to standing up, but I'll try to sit down.
I don't know if I can read and stand up at the same time.
First of all, I'm the only one that doesn't have a bio, because I just personally don't believe in those, but it dawned on me, if you wanted to get in touch with me, let me give you my number. It's 532-4714. I work with the school cafeterias, and I think it's probably in some restrooms across the way in the state of Tennessee, because I get lots of calls. If you work with food, the first thing you do learn is to be flexible. How many of you eat almost every day? Almost everyone in here. It's kind of like education. How many of you have actually been to at least one day of school? Let me see your hand. Okay, because we eat and because we're educated or have been educated, we all become experts. There's where you have the conflict in people with knowledge versus what you're going to say and what you're going to do, because everybody does become an expert. I brought you some handouts which have absolutely nothing to do with the topic. I did my speech, and then I think everybody regrouped, and so that one's out. But you do have some nice handouts, because as a former teacher, everyone likes handouts, right? I work with the National School Lunch Program. How big is this? My budget's $329 million. Pretty big, huh? That's money that goes back to the schools in the state of Tennessee. We believe very strongly, and I'm very passionate, that you cannot teach a hungry child. Doesn't matter if it's transient hunger or true hunger, you cannot teach them. As a former teacher, I can attest to that. We see, and I challenge you, especially in the rural areas, if we go to school on Monday morning and get there at 6:45 or 6:30, there are children there waiting to eat who have not eaten since lunch on Friday. It should not happen in the state of Tennessee, but it does. We are an entitlement program. Do y'all know what that means? A lot of people, I'm going to tell you, I know you know, but forget it. A lot of people think we're a welfare program. Have you heard that? The school lunch program is a welfare program? It's only for reduced kids and free? It's not. You're an entitlement program, and it simply means they're entitled to the money they earn for doing something. So the cafeterias across the state are entitled to the dollars they earn based on serving a meal that meets certain requirements. We've made changes over the years. I think with No Child Left Behind, y'all are familiar with that. We've gone from making sure children get enough to eat to looking at the obesity factor. So I said our new mantra is going to be No Child Left with the Fat Behind. We're just going to change the name. The people in the cafeterias are the only people that see every single child every day. What an impact is that? I love the people. We have people out there working as managers and workers on minimum wage, or who are procurement directors, who are counselors, who are attorneys for the stepfather who wants to see if his wife's lying and getting free lunches. They're nutritionists, whether they need to be or not. I have a staff that has some registered dietitians. I have some that are former teachers. We get money for every meal we serve, and every child, if you have, how many of you have children or have been a child? Like, this is a good group, almost 100% on everything. We get money even for the paid child. My children, the government gave 23 cents for every meal he ate. Did y'all know that? We give a lot more, like $2.37 this year, $2.47 this year for a free child, less 40 cents for the reduced, and the 23 for the paid child. How were we set up? Why were we set up? I'm going to take this straight from the law. It says, our mission is to strengthen the nation's nutrition safety net by providing nutrition meals. Isn't that wonderful? And the second mission is to support the agriculture markets. Bet you didn't know that. Our program came about in 1946. Why? We had people trying to get in the military that couldn't pass the physical. Could not do it. And so we said, they're getting some food, but it's not good. We need to do something. Then in 1949, we discovered that the farmers had surplus of products they couldn't get rid of. And so they started buying them to give to the schools. Over 60% of the product that's bought, and that equals to about 23 cents per meal, has to come from surplus industry. Now you ask, what's surplus? Ironically enough, and I shouldn't say this, the president sometimes determines the surplus. I know you're going to find that hard to believe. We had a surplus during the Reagan administration of Fig Nuggets that looked kind of like rat poo-poo. Y'all remember those? Try giving those away in the schools. And you had to mix it with something. They're picking it out going, I've not seen this before. But they were little fig pellets. That's what we like to call them. And they made pretty good projectiles for the children. Then when Jimmy Carter was in president, guess what they had a surplus of that year? Anybody know?
Peanuts.
Yes. What irony in that. And then Bush 1 came in, and guess what we had a surplus of in Texas? Come on, y'all.
Beef.
And then Clinton came, and guess what there was a surplus of? What's big in Arkansas? Tyson chicken. We had a surplus of chicken. So it's kind of ironic. The surplus goes with the presidency. How can we be a remedy? For breakfast, we have to provide at least 1/4 of minimum nutritional requirements. For lunch, we have to provide 1/3. I did a little math because sometimes people accuse us of making them.
Are you saying the requirements for the day?
The minimum yes, for the day. The minimum nutritional requirements for the day. There are 1,095 meals a child could eat during a given year, correct? If you multiply 3 times 365, and I didn't include leap year. Of that, we probably feed them 360 meals at most. So we don't have a chance to make as much impact as we have, as we would like. But do we have a lunch program in Tennessee? 100% of the schools in the state of Tennessee are on the National School Lunch Program. I told everybody I wasn't going to retire until that happened, and now they're wishing I would go ahead because it happened 5 years ago. But I'm really proud of that. We have 95% of our schools on the school breakfast program in the state of Tennessee. Astronomical. Still not enough kids eating. About 30% of the kids that eat lunch actually eat breakfast. So we're not real proud of that. What are some challenges we have? And you tell me, I'm trying to talk really fast.
We're good.
Yeah. Let me tell you what you have to have if you have a lunch. You have to have a half pint of milk. You have to have 2 servings of fruit and vegetable. It can be 2 fruits or 2 vegetables or 1 fruit and vegetable, 3/4 cup. You have to have 2 ounces of meat or a meat alternate. So it could be the peanut butter, the 2 ounces. Then you have to have at least 1 serving of bread every day. Now keep in mind, all these schools have to operate nonprofit, but they get no help from the school board itself. So they're all self-sufficient. The average price of lunch in Tennessee is $1.50 to the student. I challenge y'all to go to a restaurant, doesn't matter if it's McDonald's or where, and see if you can get a meat and a bread and 2 fruits and vegetables and a milk for $1.50. I don't think it will ever happen, so we're proud of what we do. What concerns us and impacts all of you? We know that milk consumption is down and we need to increase it. We know by increasing it, if we go to the little plastic chugs, children will drink more milk. But then what happens with plastic chugs? Then we kill the environment. So things that we do are never ending. They've taken the growth hormone, and I think effective February 1st, Kroger is, other places have done the same. They're taking it out of the milk supply. It's increased the cost of milk 2 to 3 cents per half pint. You know, that's important. It's important that we don't have the growth hormone in there, but you need to keep in mind that it also increases the price of other things. We have to buy American. I know she said most of the food comes from 2,000 miles away. Now, I'm thinking that's going to be the other side of California, right? But our law says if you spend our money on it, it has to be American unless you have a dang good reason not to buy it American. What are the reasons you can't get it anywhere else? Y'all know what you can't get anywhere else? What's a fruit you can't get anywhere else? What?
Mangoes.
You cannot, a lot of things. The most popular thing you cannot get domestically is pineapple. Dole and them quit making it. They only do it for the tourists. You cannot get pineapple here. You cannot get mandarin oranges here. But it is a scary thought. I don't have to make the decision. The supervisors do. Do I buy grapes from China or from Chile so the kids can get the fruit, which you want them to have, but they may not have the safety standards that you know that we have. It's a battle they have to fight. We must also review every application. That's what I said. Children turn in applications to be free or reduced. We also pick up 54% of the kids in Tennessee are on free and reduced price, 54%. You get to Memphis, it's more like 70 or 80%. Half of those will turn in a piece of paper that we have to monitor. The other half we get straight from the food stamps. If you're on food stamps or 10, if you're automatically eligible for a free meal in Tennessee. One other thing you might not know in Tennessee, which I think is a big boon, if you receive free or reduced price lunches, you do not have to pay a fee for anything. If you're in the band and they require an instrument, they cannot make you pay for the instrument. If you're going to graduate and you have to have a cap and gown, they cannot make you pay for that. So it's kind of high on the schools, but we're really proud of it. In genetically engineered food, they're trying to get that into the market. I don't ever go to those because that part of me is kind of scared. I don't want a radiated cow, but that's me personally. We don't have anything nice to tell about being a farmer. I went to college on tobacco money, so it sounds so much better if you were a milk farmer, but I wasn't. Other things that affect us, did any of y'all see the headlines last night on the news? It was kind of a lead story, and it really irritated me, and I won't say which Channel 4 that it was on, because that wouldn't be nice, but I'm sitting there, and I hear them say, parents, should you pack your child's lunch because of the beef? And I'm going, I think I sent out that hold on all of that, but let's make sure. Well, when it comes on, it goes, that's been put on hold in Tennessee. But how many parents do you think never got beyond that one thing? And now they're afraid of eating the school cafeteria. We have to meet HACCP standards. We get the highest grades. Our average grade is 96 and above for health inspections. So we're proud of what we do. We do glean foods. Ethnic foods have made a big impact. The Hispanic population has brought lots of fruits and vegetables that we never would have had before. Oprah bought the pomegranate with her martini. If y'all remember that. Hey, y'all, how many of y'all seen that in the store before it was on Oprah's show? Well, it wasn't in Lebanon, I can tell y'all that, because I live in Lebanon. And now there's like rows of pomegranates. I don't know that people use them for anything other than that. But we've introduced kiwi and fresh fruits. And it's really been great, y'all, for everyone. It's been great for everyone just because of the population shift. Some of the schools glean. That means if they have leftovers that they can't do anything with, we can take them to some other places that maybe can use the food, some nonprofits. And there's some minimal nutritional standards. I left them up here in the state of Tennessee affecting grades K through 8, what they can sell and what they can actually serve. And I'll answer any questions. Thank you for your time.
You know, it's kind of interesting when you think about the health impacts of our food systems, it's not an easy answer. And what we tried to, with the speakers today and the panelists, with their experiences, to touch on different pieces that impact. The food school system, that's an infrastructure that has impact on the health of all children. And then you think about Barbara's program, where she's working in rural communities in a variety of different states that are up here. You know, the poverty, I mean, that plays a huge impact on the health. Of people, and then with the Metro Public Health Department, there's tons of programs that impact health in there, from WIC programs where a mom goes to get support while she's when she has a child, with different programs that they're able to do. So I hope that this has given you some idea of some of the things and has started your brain thinking, so that we can open it up for some questions and maybe even has sparked an idea of something you'd like to see. Questions? Yeah. And why doesn't everybody stand up and say what your name is, and then your question.
Okay. I'm Jennifer Tlumak. Thanks, panelists. I wanted to pick up on something that Ms. White talked about, which was the genetically engineered foods, and you just quickly mentioned that sort of they're trying to get it into this. So I'd like you to elaborate on who they are and what that is, and then also if the other panelists have.
Okay. And according to USDA, it's perfectly all right, and it's not my choice, so I can say that. It's up to the individual schools whether or not they want the genetically engineered food. The manufacturers that make the product are the ones that want it in the schools, because it is big business. Normally, in most small school systems, we are the largest industry. The school nutrition program is the largest industry in that particular county. We take in more money from students. Can you hear me okay? So there was a big push a while back for the beef to come in, and then some legislators heard, and they said, well, maybe not. It may be perfectly fine. I'm not an expert on that. There's a person out there now that has a new genetically engineered milk that's not really milk. Right now, USDA says that we have to offer a variety of milk. We have taken out all whole milk out of the schools. Those are not available. We took that out 10 years ago before anyone asked us to do it. The chocolate milk is 1.5%, and it has been for the last 20 years. It does not yet recognize soy milk as being fluid milk. There's a push, and I think the soy milk will become real milk within the next year. But then there's some other, I call it pretend milk. I'm sure there's a big scientific name for it. And it has the nutrients. It's just not, when it comes from a tree, for some reason it's not milk to me. I grew up on a farm. But I'm sure it's perfectly, I don't get it. I'm old. Did that help? Because they're manufactured, this is big. We are big business, folks. When we changed the minimum nutrition standards, and Rublin was on there, we said in Tennessee, a cookie can be no larger than 1 ounce, and that's not a very big cookie either. If you want to sell it at all in grades K through 8, and the manufacturers came down and they were mad at everyone, and we said milk couldn't be larger than 8 ounces, and they got mad at everyone, and people start politically going with the legislators and stuff. There's not an easy answer. I don't know that there's an easy answer. I really don't. It's the radiated meat safer? They used to say it was. Now they're saying it's not. The milk, the HRT, what they've taken out, the bovine growth hormone, they've just taken it out this year. Now, maybe some other places have later, but Publix was the first to announce it. And they're saying, look at the girls. Look at the high school girls, based on the high school girls we went to school with. You know, this growth hormone, I'm sure, has affected people. But you get 15% more production out of your cattle with a growth hormone. So it keeps your price lower.
You have a question. I'm Meredith Freeman. And I guess my question is, I work with schools and service learning programs. And what my ideal would be to see students growing their own food that is then served in the cafeteria on site. Are there restrictions to that? Do you see a push for that in Tennessee? It's more cost-effective, and students are learning about growing their own food and relating it back to their students.
I would say it's probably not more cost-effective. It may be. I doubt it. Well, with the farmers, let me go back to that, because a lot of people would like to see the farmers selling to schools, and we would love for that to happen. Unfortunately, in Tennessee, there's not a big growing season when school's actually in session. So what you can sell may not be being produced when school's in session. You may get a few tomatoes. The other thing in schools, because of USDA's requirement in order to get this meal, you have to meet exact criteria. So if I'm going to have a potato and it has to be 1.5 ounces, I can't have a 7-ounce one over here and 1/18 ounce one here and average it out. Each potato, there has to be, you know, some consistency and some uniformity in each of the vegetables. By the way, this next week I'm sending out information. Contact your schools, push them. I'm going to get $250,000. I'm going to put grants in 25 schools to provide more fruits and vegetables in the schools. They're going to come up with ideas. I'm telling them to work with their health, to work with other partners. But if you're near a school, volunteer to work with them. part of that is they can actually buy the seeds. I think I've heard from Lawrence County wants to do some of that. You would never do it whole scale, like in a 1,000-person school.
Right, but just the idea of students, it goes back to that education of how do you get a new generation to understand how to grow and to feel good about what they've done and to have healthy food, and it's pretty much free after you bought the
seeds. I'm glad to see that, and I think it worked really well in the Boys and Girls Clubs. At the schools, probably you wouldn't have to have security to make sure someone doesn't do anything bad to the fruits and vegetables. Not that kids would do that, but that has become a problem. You know, they think it's funny to go to the restroom, like on the food, and that's funny to a teenager. It's not funny to us. But, you know, you have to have security. You have to have it inside. The agriculture departments, we would applaud anybody who wants to do it, and it will have to be a small scale or a small school, I think. Love to have it happen.
And I think some pilot programs like that are happening. Not maybe exactly, but I think it goes back to what Sarah says. If you have a partnership with a local elementary school or middle school, contact that school, become a part of their PTO and work with them. I know that there's some pilot programs going on at Glendale locally that we're working on a CSA where the school gets their own CSA, and then one is given away to one of the families at the school. And, you know, there's some unique programs that are out there, and lots of options and lots of people to partner
and
with.
And by law, everyone has to have a wellness policy in place as of July 1 of last year. Every school system has to have a wellness policy. Volunteer to be on their wellness partner and make that part of the overall wellness policy.
We'll go in the back, and then we'll go this way.
My name is Cindy Delvin, and I'm a farmer. With Delvin Farms in Williamson County and Davidson County. And we are one of the very fortunate ones who have partnered with the school, Harvard Hall. And it has been a wonderful relationship, and you are so correct. And I'm sitting here thinking during your talk, which I thoroughly enjoyed, is, would they buy from local growers? But the problem is there aren't enough local growers to provide the amount of food that the school systems would use. So we're very fortunate in that we partnered with an individual school, and we are the Glendale connection as well. And we give a share to that particular school. And at Harpeth Hall, we actually provide the food for their lunches, for their salad bars and everything. But again, we come into the problem that school ends before the growing season really starts again. But we were able to provide them from August right on through to December. And so if there are growers who could partner with a school that is flexible enough to work within the confines of a local grower, it is an absolute wonderful match. And with Glendale, we go all the way through November with them, from May through November. So if it is at all possible to partner with one particular school, it is a total blessing. And I have been trying to write as fast as you were talking, and you're a wonderful speaker.
Well, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Can I just comment? I think you're making a really good point, and I just wanted to sort of, at the risk of saying something obvious, all of this is really a web. You know, the schools are producing food, the farmers are growing food, the agribiz folks are in the state houses making sure that their profit is maximized. Mm-hmm. It's all connected. And that's part of the difficulty that we face, is that although it's all connected, we're operating in different little, you know, you've got your set of rules and you've got to go with those and that sort of thing. But that is one thing that organizations like this can do, is try to keep the focus on the interwoven nature of it, so that like there is a movement, and I don't know the educational ins and outs about this, you know, to have some schools open 12 months a year, and there are certain educational arguments that are being made, don't know if, you know, but that if that were to happen, that helps address one of these problems, you know. It's all sort of
My name is Cindy Moonrose, and I'm going to give some information. It's a little contradictory. I am growing food 12 months out of the year to feed my face. And Tennessee's temperature is getting moderate enough. There are a lot of cold, hardy vegetables. You can't grow squash, but you can grow salad greens. And you can grow the Asian vegetables are incredible. And you can grow the cold crops, which is cabbage, broccoli, you know. But I'm just using the sun and plastic because you get the wind off of these things, they do fine. A lot of these things can freeze solid and they come back. It's amazing. The big lettuce can't, the baby lettuce can, and baby lettuce is getting to be a big deal.
And that's very true. And you can grow an individual family and an individual partnership, but when you start growing on a full scale for the metro school system, and you have hoop houses everywhere.
And deliver it to 158 schools and 2 days a week.
And I would love to see something like that so that people are aware of where their food comes from and know their local farmer, and that the value of agriculture would be back instead of, we have bought this this prototype of the farmer being uneducated and they're farming because they can't do anything else. And so that stereotype that we have fought for years and years of trying to let people know that farmers can put two sentences together. And, so we want people to know where their food is coming from and value education. Education and agriculture are the two segments of our society that we put our least value in. And so that's what we're trying to get, is to put these two together and realize the value of both segments of our life. And so you can grow in hoop houses, but it would be unrealistic to think that there are enough farmers to supply all the food sources that our metro schools would need.
But if
somebody can partner with individual schools, yeah, I understand.
And there's also, I mean, schools are one system, and it was the one, we can't have the whole different groups. Schools are one system. There's employers. We'll hear later today about a hospital, farm-to-hospital type of program. So after-school programs, we've mentioned the Boys and Girls Club. So it's thinking outside the box. It's thinking, okay, where are all the different places that consumers are that purchase the food? Because in reality, adults are the ones that are purchasing the food for their family. So, and they're the role models for the kids. And so just thinking that outside the box. Next question. Go ahead, and then we'll go to the back.
My name is Gail Hutchinson, and I direct a cardiology practice, and I'm also in school to become a registered dietitian. Because I recognized long ago that the next frontier is going to be about food and water. So, as we shift in the nation to understand better what we put in our face, as you said, feed your face, we've been on this track, in my view, a long time of not understanding what we needed to do to improve the health and well-being of our citizens. One of the things that I did as a child or young person was work for the Panther Program that founded the breakfast program in this country. And most people don't know that because it was a very small effort in localized urban areas, but part of what that grew out of was the need of children coming to school unable to learn because they were hungry. And the Panther Party partnered with many local growers of food to provide the food for the nutritional benefit of the young people. But what they also did, which is somehow missing here, is they took the kids, because I was a volunteer to do this as a teenager, to the store and showed them how to look at food. What was nutritionally sound? What did a vegetable look like? What do you do with these vegetables? The different kinds of vegetables. And they did it starting where they lived and then branched them out into other areas where there were grocery stores, because this was in the 60s. So I'm, one of the things that, and another part of this is, and I'm not trying to make a speech here, but another part of my career was to do I was the survey director for the school breakfast and lunch program evaluation for the USDA. So I went all over the country with my staff to evaluate the nutritional content as well as the programmatic breakfast and lunch program. And we do owe these young ladies a great deal of applause, because they do things as best they can with limited resources to do that. But again, part of it is educating not only the students, but the parents. One of the programs that was most successful was in California, where they actually had classes with PTA casing on them to teach parents how to look for nutritional value in what they could afford. Not what, you know, Martha Stewart says that you're supposed to eat, but what do you have available to you? So one of the things I think that I'm seeing is, as I said a few minutes ago, we have silo effect in this country. You know, this entity is not talking to this entity because this entity wants to protect their resources. So in order to do that, we're going to have to crosswalk. This is a good idea, the summits. But this summit needs to have more parents involved. You know, we're all here because we're interested in this. But, you know, this outreach, and I challenge this group to reach to the people that need to hear what you have to say. We're smart enough to be here. You need to go to the people who need to talk to you because they don't get this resource. So if it means that you, you know, figure out a way with each individual school in Metro or how that works, or you have an outreach with your staff, that's where the education is gapped. Mm-hmm. It's those people.
We're going back.
I'm Preston Merritt, one of your speakers. California from the hospital system. And I just want to say I just absolutely love, be pragmatic, on the ground, here's how it works, here's the reality, here's what day-to-day life is all about. I love hearing what all of you have shared, and what I wrestle with is the same thing. I mean, in a hospital, I can't get food for patients who are 85 years old, have had a hip replacement, and may have no teeth. And it can't come up with a fresh carrot or a fresh broccoli for dip. We've got to get something that's a specified size. It's got to be chewable. It's got to have X amount of calories and this and that and a little piece. You know, it's exactly the same as your school service, except it's at a hospital setting with all the special diets. But what I've chosen to do and what I see here is that people are taking advantage of what is possible and celebrate that. You're serving one school. That's fine. You're not serving 100 schools. We don't have the hoop gardens in all year round, but if you can do it for one place at a time, one step at a time, it starts the conversation. So what I love hearing is that you're celebrating what's possible and not bemoaning what you can't do. Because you may have X amount you can do with a cookie this big and milk this big, but is it possible to bring in a little something extra that's locally grown in partnership with local farmers? I love the conversation. I look forward to joining all of you.
We'll go here, purple, gray, and then in the back. So everybody has their line, because we have about 5 minutes until we've got to end.
My name is Sarah Wood, and I'm just an individual here in Tennessee, just curious about all of this. But as, you know, looking forward into my future and having kids and getting them into the school system and wanting to teach them, you know, healthy choices for eating, something that I just see that might be a simple thing to remove from hospitals, from schools, from, you know, places that kids have to go to or that when they're sick we have to go to. Is there any discussion about just removing fryers?
I would say there are fryers probably in Tennessee schools, probably in less than 10% of the schools. The thing about food with children, and I don't want to sound deceptive, but if children know what they're eating, sometimes they don't eat it. Mm-hmm. We have not had pepperoni made out of anything other than turkey for over 15 years that I know of. Ground beef has been turkey. The corn dogs have been turkey. The fries have been baked. But if you put turkey pepperoni pizza, and low-fat mozzarella cheese on the menu, they'll be going, but it tastes right to them now because they eat it. There are still some people that fry. You'll see it a lot in the high schools. And sometimes that has to do with how the old schools are old, how much storage they have, how much labor they have, and labor's your highest cost of any meal. It's around 60%, 55%, 60% in Metro where they're labor unions. You have to get the kids out there quickly, and you cannot weed out quickly that way. On the other hand, almost all of them have gone to the trans-fat-free oil, and that's another issue I didn't touch on, y'all. I've been meeting with legislatures. We sat there the other day with some Twinkies, Peeps, Pepsi, and Cheetos, and the legislator just happened to call me because he's pushing trans-fat-free, and I said, oh, we're healthy. We've got them right here on our table looking at them. So, you know, that's not always the answer to get rid of trans-fat. Because we could have eaten Peeps, Pepsi, Cheetos, and whatever else I said, the little things, and it would be trans fat free. So we're moving that way in schools. We have to do it slowly. They have to bid out a year in advance. You have to bid everything over $10,000 has to be bid. It does increase the cost. If you increase the cost, you've got to increase your participation or cut back on something else, because it is, you're self-sufficient, we're self-sufficient. Yeah, but they, very few of them actually fry anymore.
And I guess just using that as an example of, you know, trying to think of just simple things that we can just remove altogether that, you know, will help with the obesity issue and pushing, you know, the...
And the whole grain, you know, we've gone to a lot of whole grain. We've gone to lots of whole grains. We have several goat schools in Tennessee. We have more schools of excellence in Tennessee than any other state in the entire nation. So, yes, they're doing it a little at a time. But what you can't do is not feed the kids. And real fast, USDA came up with a, they had, you know, they hired somebody politically. About 12 years ago, they got someone new in, and she decided everybody, every child in Tennessee need to eat couscous and something else and put in their blender in the afternoon. And I'm looking at her and I'm going, we don't even know what it is in Tennessee. And I've taught in the inner city, and they don't all have blenders. Some of them don't have electricity. So sometimes you have people making decisions that have nothing to do with reality. So it is a small movement.
I'm Dan Strasser. I grew up and live on a family farm. I just happen to work for the Tennessee Department of Agriculture also. And in that role, I try to connect farmers with their markets. And I'm proud of what you're doing, and all of y'all, Cindy does an excellent job. Hawkins County's had some great success with Bill Davidson and connecting a family farm to the school. So I'm proud of those things. And I think what we can do here more than anything is the networking and staying in touch, opening up possibilities for the institutions and also the farmers. I think it's great that everybody's here. We have, you know, not only Tennessee, but the nation has abundant and safe food stores. I think it's important to remember that it's not, we don't have to throw away what we have. We have options for alternative agriculture and different things, but we do have safe food. And I'd be remiss if I didn't say that BST in milk is naturally recurring. We never had it on our farm. A lot of farmers don't, especially anymore. But it's in all milk. And it was, the bovine somatotropin hormone she mentioned. It's in all milk. It's natural. It's never synthetic, so it's not going to harm the milk. But
they are using something to, or they are using something to increase production that has that in it as well, right?
Yeah, that's BSC,
right?
But most farmers don't use it. There's a time when a lot of farmers got into it, but then the concerns come up, and everybody's concerned about being safe and providing the right food source, so they're very conscious of it.
And in the back, and then we'll try to get to you, and you'll be our last one.
I'm John McFadden, and I really wanted to go back. Mark Clinton, by the way, I got a 7-year-old, and you will be the new reason about no more Happy Meals for him. But I wanted to go back. You had kind of alluded to something about the school program and getting to, not the school program, that the Panthers were involved in. And it seems to me there's really two kind of core issues or core messages that are coming out of this discussion, or that's what I'm seeing. One is getting to the, you call it the family cycle, Barb, when you were talking. And, you know, that's like the heart of this entire issue, because I had that guy, Reverend Jim Deming, told me the other day, he said, John, if you want to see yourself, just look at your son. And I started watching how he was eating. I was like, oh my God, you know, he's copying me. That's what he's doing. He's copying me. So I'm really the issue there for his eating behavior or habits, food choices, etc., etc. And then the other thing, I don't care how you approach the issue or how you look at the issue, but you better be talking about how it impacts, positively impacts our economy, because that's where we'll win politically. And a lot of this is really about politics, folks. I mean, it really is. We need to be supporting a very robust local agricultural community. And that's driving the economy. That's what it's doing. So with that, Bart, thank you so much, because you are going to get the run.
I'll look forward to it.
I'm Teresa Thomas, and I'm with Metro Public Health Department Nutrition Services Director. And I wanted to say one thing about farming, and the need that we have is almost the opposite of what you've been hearing here, is we have a commodity foods program, and it's for the 60 and older in the summers, and well, it's all year, but in the summers they receive a voucher for $15 worth of fresh fruits and vegetables. We cannot find enough farmers in Davidson County to send our folks to for the product. Wow. It's about approximately $150,000 worth that they receive for those 2 months. And we only have two farmers that that supply those produce, the fruits and vegetables. So we have a great need in Davidson County for more farmers to produce, to supply that food source for our participants. And, you know, we hear this of these are the farmers and we want to get more of our produce into the schools and more of our here. We have the need for it for you all, but we don't have the farmers to supply that. So that's something that most people don't think about. We're out here crying for you, and you're on this side crying for us, but we're not connected. You have to meet a certain criteria for that. It has to be Tennessee-grown product. I mean, there is a criteria. But in Davidson County, we only have two farmers that do supply that for us. So we need you.
I think we've heard from a lot of different potential partners in the room today, from Metro Public Health Department to MyHow to the State Nutrition Program for Schools to farmers in the room to the Children's Hospital is very interested in this issue because we continue to see the effects on health with kids, and we now know that our kids, the kids now are not expected to live as long as their parents are now, and that's a huge thing for us that we're trying to combat. And we feel like that access to food, nutritious food, is one of those root problems that we want to continue to work towards solving. And so I encourage you to reach out, and if you have opportunities, if you think, oh, I have a brainstorm, call somebody and say, can I sit down and talk with you? Can we pull some folks together? Cassie, and I don't mean to go back to this, but Cassie mentioned the Veggie Project in her opening remarks, and that came out of a food security partners meeting of somebody standing up and saying that they wanted to do farmers markets. And we were able to bring 5-6 different groups together to put it together. And it's and those are the types of things that I think through the day, through all the different conversations and the dialogue we're having today, that I'd love to see 7 more of those types of projects happen.
Could I just mention a couple of books that I think would be?
Sure.
I'm Corey Weiser, and I haven't had a chance, and I'm just really glad everybody has shared. There's 2 books that I'm currently reading that I think kind of addresses some of these things. Our disconnect with nature, mm-hmm. and some children don't even know that things grow in the ground, and it's dirty. It grows out of dirt. There's I think it's called The Last Child or The Last Boy in the Woods, mm-hmm. and Last Child in the Woods. You're right. And it talks about, and it goes into a lot of the family kind of things. And then Kingsolver, who is a very famous author, has written a book, Animal Vegetable Miracle. And again, she's going on down the whole line of how our food comes to us. So I just wanted to mention those. They're really good.
Thank you.
Books.
They're great. They're great books. Yeah. And I can't help but say this. I think nutrition is one facet of the obesity epidemic that we're facing, but it's just one piece of it. There's active living. There's so many other pieces that play into it. So I couldn't not say it.
please take a handout. Please take some of this, because I don't want to take them back.
And please give our panelists a round of applause.
Great.